I see neurosurgery residency as a training program. It's an educational experience and mentorship is important, but it's a training program.
Welcome everybody to this edition of the AANS CNS Pediatric Neurosurgery Insights on Pediatric Neurosurgery podcast series. Today we will be meeting with Dr. Robert Bolo, who is Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Primary Children's Hospital, University of Utah, and Fellowship Director for the Pediatric Neurosurgery Fellowship, and Dr. Ariana Barkley, who is a recently graduated fellow from the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and one of the rising faculty at the University of New Mexico, and Dr. Heather Spader, who is one of the faculty on the pediatric neurosurgery team at University of New Mexico, Department of Neurosurgery.
What recommendations do you have about picking programs?
I'm happy to go first, but I unless you want to, Ariana.
No. I can go first, I guess, since I just went through the process. But in terms of like picking programs, initially it was completely based on my mentors, you know, like the people that they knew, how they knew, or the information they knew about the culture of various places and how like my personality as an applicant would fit in that culture and what I was looking for. And so I think it takes a lot of just sitting down and self-reflection. Like this is a point where, you know, it's not necessarily about even like a location or like a particular name or anything like that. It's really about what you want to do with your career, like the type of impact you want to make and the patient population that you want to see, and then reflect on your training and see, like, be honest with yourself about where you think there are holes or gaps or things that you want more experience in. And I think that like, I battled with this during fellowship about staying or going elsewhere. And I think that now that I've gone elsewhere, I would highly recommend that to nearly everybody, just to see like a different way of doing things, like different, decision making, like a different system, learning that system. Like, I think all of those are really important skills too. And after at least I spent, you know, 7 great years over at UW, I like love the PEDS people there. I learned a lot from them. And I'm also glad that I went to UAB and I learned a lot of other new techniques and different ways of thinking about things. So I think it really depends on like what you feel like you need in order to make yourself the best pediatric neurosurgeon that you can be, that you have like a broad skill set so that you can actually help the population that you're going to serve afterwards. And I would highly recommend going elsewhere.
So I think that was very eloquently said, and I would agree 100% with the main themes and comments that you made. So I would just say a couple of things. You know, I think that we can talk about location. We can talk about job opportunities that may or may not be materialized. I certainly think going elsewhere is important, which I'll probably get into a little bit later. But I think that, so I'll just relate a story, Ariana, to what you said, which is that when I interviewed for residency and I interviewed in Seattle, well, you know, it was a 2-day process and there were only 2 of us at a time. And I think one of the last interview on the first day was with George Ogeman when he was still in practice. And he had this office where there were journals sort of stacked on every shelf to the ceiling, and it wasn't a lot of space. And he just sat back and asked me what I thought the most important thing was in terms of applying for residency. And I thought I gave a reasonable answer, although I don't recall exactly what it was. But I asked him at the end, because that seemed to be a very important question to him. So I asked him at the end what he thought the best answer to that question was. And he said, mentorship. Mm-hmm. And I think he's 100% right. And I think you're 100% right. I think that you have to develop professional relationships with people that have tackled. He expounded on this, so I'm trying to paraphrase something from a long time ago that he said, but basically that, you know, people have you know, you're going to encounter obstacles throughout your career in every stage, and you're going to, you need people that will help you through those, be they early in their career when you are, or they're, you know, they're just a little bit ahead of you, or people that, you know, are more senior. And so you need mentors will help you, you know, whatever you'd like to do with your career, private practice or academics, cranial or spinal, whatever part of neurosurgery you want to do, you need to find mentors. And so you need to emphasize that as much as you possibly can. And I think he's 100% right. And I think that even more applies for fellowship in a fairly small community of pediatric neurosurgeons. And so that's, if that's mentorship in terms of an exceptional spine experience or an epilepsy experience or a neuro-oncology experience, or that's, you know, like, I think that that's more important on some level than geography. I think that that's more important on some level than, although I think a broad exposure to all aspects of pediatric neurosurgery is critical, I think mentorship is probably more important.
Hey, Vijay, we were just talking about kind of the process that we went through in picking programs and why. And I think both Ariana and Rob were talking about mentorship. I don't know if you want to add anything about why or how you picked the program that you picked.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things for me. You know, in general, I was given advice to kind of seek a broad spectrum of programs to see what's out there. And I think that was really important for me to see, especially coming from one place and seeing how things are done in one institution. I think it's important to kind of see what other training paradigms are out there. And I think that's a really important thing. And I'm sure you maybe touched on this, but one piece of advice that I got from Dr. J. Reva Cameron was, you know, and obviously this was less pertinent to me, but he said, you know, you need to go to places where you think you could potentially think about wanting to get a job, whether your goals or visions align with that program, or you have mentorship opportunities there, or they may have a need that you are able to fill with your skill set or your interests. And I think that's a super important thing that I actually tell people that ask for advice for fellowship from me, saying, hey, like, think about where you want to work and maybe focus on those types of places, because you never know when they'll be looking to expand or if there's going to be turnover in personnel or what have you. So I think those are two really important things to look at.
I think when I think when everybody's looking, like, a lot of things that people focus on are like, well, what's the call schedule like? Is it resident call? Is it fellow call? Is it attending call? And then are the cases are different based on whether you're primary call, or, you know, and that was something that a lot of people focused on in the interview group. And having just finished fellowship, I guess, Ariana, how important do you think those factors really were?
Well, it's interesting because I think at the very beginning of the process, when I was going over programs with my mentors in Seattle, it wasn't a significantly important factor, but it was a more important factor at that point than it was when I was actually making my rank list at the end of all of the interviews. Like, it fell to the bottom of the list in terms of how important the call schedule was to me anyway, just because of the things that I knew that I was looking for. And initially, like, I was like, oh, I want, you know, to have like attending level call. I want to get that experience for the year. Like, I want to be able to staff my own cases and things like that. And one of the arguments, one of the arguments for that are what I just said, but the arguments against it are like, you know, I feel like I know myself. If there was a case that came in overnight that was like a shunt revision that, you know, needed to go right then and there, like, I'd want to take care of it there. If it was some another case that needed to be taken care of, like, in the morning, I would feel responsible for taking care of that patient and that case that came in, even to the detriment probably of experiencing some of the other more complicated cases where you can be scrubbed with one of your mentors during fellowship at that time. And I think some of the programs that had you on attending call, they were like, oh, you know, we're good about like taking over cases from the night before, and we have you, you know, scrub whatever you'd like the next day. And I just felt like I wouldn't be able to do that. Like, I would just feel too attached to, like, you know, I'd feel responsible for that that particular family. And one of the pros, I guess, to being on primary call or not necessarily being on attending call is, I mean, we know, you know, well, I would hope that you know how to take call by the end of your residency and like manage all of those things and all of the things that come in overnight in an efficient way. And then by the next morning, you kind of have your pick essentially of cases, whether it's taking juniors through or whether it's a more complicated case that you're going to do with your attending. And I ended up initially I was looking for a place that had attending call, and I ended up really loving my call with my primary call experience at UAB. And one of it was honestly overnight, like I could handle a lot of the things that were coming in probably faster than being like, okay, I listening to it either from a nurse practitioner or a junior resident or something like that. And I know at the beginning of the year, I'd want to go in and double check and make sure that everything was okay. And so just being the primary person to go in and take care of it was a little kind of faster, to me. And then I felt like I had my hands kind of on the service in terms of controlling how things were running, and, that I knew that everything that had happened the night before. So I think that like the call experience, it didn't really kind of factor into my decision at the end of the application process. And I think there are pros and cons to both. And it depends on what the applicant or what you're looking for in your fellowship experience.
Ariana, can I ask you a question? And I have a answer of my own, which I'm going to share. But now that you've started your junior attendinghood, as I'm well into my junior attendinghood as well, what do you wish you would have done more of or less of in fellowship?
That's a great question. So I asked this question to all the fellows when I was interviewing, and what they told me was clinic.
Yeah.
They were like, I wish 1000% more clinic, like just so that I know how to like partition out the people that I'm actually going to do surgery on. How do I follow them? Like, how long do I follow them? What are the intervals? And so I made sure that I went to every one of my attendings clinics, at least once, you know, and all of like the subspecialty clinics. And so I think that in all honesty, I probably would still say that, because there are things that I've come to UNM and I'm like, they didn't read the book. Like, what, you know, there's so many nuances to decision making. And I, you know, I'm lucky I have great partners to bounce ideas off of and a broad mentors, or a broad range of mentors to bounce ideas off of. But I think we completely underestimate the importance of clinic, right? Because we're surgeons, we want to operate.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really interesting point is like, you know, we focus on all these things like, oh, like, is it Q2 or Q3 primary call? Okay. And then halfway through my fellowship year, I could tell you it didn't matter. You know, yeah. I mean, what I probably, the questions I should have asked is, what's the relationship like between the fellow and the residents? Yeah. And is it something that needs to be improved upon? Where I did my fellowship, that was something that needed to be improved. And I hope I did that to make it a good experience for everybody, but it was definitely an uphill battle. And I hope it's better for people now. And I think a good working relationship is so important in that setting. And I think where I did residency, that was a very kind of symbiotic role. You know, it wasn't just I'm the person in charge and everybody is under me. And I think it's important to look at that at programs too. So,
yeah. Because I think a really important part of the fellowship process is learning how to be an effective teacher, not only an effective teacher in the way that you think that should be, but to adapt your techniques to different learning styles too. And I think that like I loved working with, they ended up switching to more junior residents when I was a fellow over at UAB. It was a 3-in-1. And I loved working with all of them. Like they all had different learning styles. They all taught me so much in terms of like how to be an effective teacher. And I think that, yeah, that relationship is also a really important part of the experience that you don't necessarily pay attention to when you're initially looking at programs.
Yeah. I think probably too, the other thing we don't think about is how much you do rely on the people that were your mentors from fellowship to call them up and ask them for advice about cases, but then it's not just cases, because we always think it must be just like cases and clinical stuff. Mm-hmm. But like it's all the other stuff too that comes up you know, and sometimes it's like politics and how do I maneuver this and how do I deal with this? And, you know, like you want people that actually have a wide variety of experience and probably at different levels of stages in their career that you can feel comfortable calling and getting that advice from. I think that's invaluable too, which I don't think ever crossed my mind once when I was applying for residency.
Rob, I have a question for you, and I apologize if you guys have already covered this, but you know, we talk about a lot about how programs or fellows pick programs and how they rank things. As a fellowship director for several years, how do you base your decision making? I mean, it's obviously not just a cookbook where you look at someone's CV and say, I'm going to rank this person first, second, third, fourth. What do you look at personally? And I guess on a bigger level, what do you think program directors are looking for when they're seeking out applicants?
I think we touched on this a little bit, but it's a great question. And I think I can probably give a more cogent answer now. But first of all, I think that there's probably a wide standard deviation in the metrics that people use to select fellowship candidates and rank them. And I think that there's a movement afoot in neurosurgery residency and in resident surgical subspecialty residencies and residencies across the board to be more fair about this, to ask standardized questions, write standardized letters, to rank people according to a point system that you pre-agreed on what the values of your program are and what you're looking for. And then, you know, to look carefully at people who are underrepresented. And I think that's really important because I think we serve communities that we come from and we need to serve all communities. And there needs to be better representation in neurosurgery in general. So I think that there's a movement afoot in residency for that. I don't think it's come to fellowship, but I think that there's an opportunity there. But I think right now there's a wide standard deviation or variation in how people select fellows. And I think that if you asked a lot of people across the country, they probably haven't written it down and probably don't have a very clear structure in their head. And a lot of it probably has to do with their impression of people. Bless you. I think that, I think from my standpoint, what we talked about earlier was I tend to de-emphasize the interview and use the interview as what my intention is, how successful I am is a different question, but my intention is to use the interview as an opportunity to sell the program to the candidates. They're going into pediatric neurosurgery, a field I'm passionate about and love. They're going to be my colleagues. I want them to see what we do in Utah. I want them to understand what the strengths of our program are. I want them to know that we know what the weaknesses are and that we're working through those things. I want them to understand that we'll treat them like a colleague. And so, you know, again, how successful we are at those things, but those are our intentions. And then in terms of, I think that the, if I had to pick the one thing that I rely on the most, it's calling colleagues or the letters from other pediatric neurosurgeons, you know, that have worked with people for 7 years. And I think, you know, the rationale I gave before, which I think applies, is, you know, you could catch somebody on a, especially now in this Zoom world, you know, all fellowship interviews are now Zoom, decided by the ACPNF, which is something I didn't know existed or was when I was applying for fellowship, but it's the Accreditation Council of Pediatric Neurosurgery Fellowships. And there's a board, and the reason it started with the pandemic, but it's continued now, and it will be indefinite, maybe until there's a change in the leadership at the ACPNF, but it's for equity because not everybody can travel to every place. And, you know, we want to make it fair from that standpoint. There's a lot of pushback from many fellowship directors about that because a lot of people think it's really important to go out and see where you are, and that Zoom interviews favor certain established programs over less established programs, which might be a great fit and people won't have the opportunity to see it. And I've certainly heard that from really well-known fellowship directors across the country that they're very much against it because they don't get to see what they, you know, they don't get to get a feel for the program that they think the candidate doesn't get that. But I think that, you know, you can catch somebody they might have been post-call, they might have just had a tragedy, they might have been dealing with a personal issue, you're, you know, on a Zoom interview with them for 20 or 30 minutes. I think that a more reliable indicator is the people that have worked with, you know, shoulder to shoulder with that person for 7 years. And so I my intention certainly is to rely on those things much more. I certainly look for people from, you know, programs where they've had a good mix of surgical training and they've gotten to the OR a lot, a great surgical experience. They can hit the ground running. That's important to us and probably to lots of people too. But that's not the primary thing. I will say there's one other thing that I look for in candidates. And so, which is that I think we all enjoy doing a wide range of things in pediatric neurosurgery. And I would just take that as a given. And I think the more mature applicant is somebody who has a vision for their career. And I look for an academic vision, but you may not want to go into academics, and that's okay. And you may go into something totally different than you tell me, and I will never hold you to it. But if you're thinking through that process and say you want to do, you know, a special training in pediatric deformity surgery or epilepsy or, you know, pediatric vascular surgery, or you want to do fetal surgery, you know, whatever it is that you have, you know, that there's an area that you're really passionate about, and you love all pediatric neurosurgery, but you want to sort of move the ball forward. And maybe you will, and maybe you won't, and that's not important. What's important is just that you're sort of diving into the topic a little bit more deeply, and there are things that, you know, and maybe there are things that you just, you know, you were exposed to in your residency, and the reason you like pediatric neurosurgery. But I think that seems to me to be a more mature applicant than the person who's just, I like doing, you know, all types of neurosurgery and I like the variety. We all, I think, like that. I think that the person who's taken it the one step further is impressive. I hope I answered your question in an extremely roundabout way.
Yeah, no, I think that was great. You bring up an interesting point, and Arianna and Heather, I welcome you because you guys are both on the academic side, and all of you are obviously, but you know, you bring up an interesting point of this virtual interview. You know, it's not something I ever dealt with. And now the Zoom kind of thing has taken over. And so Arianna, what was your experience? Did you regret not being able to get to programs to actually see the campuses? Were there places you wish you could have gotten to visit, just from a, you know, a nostalgic perspective or a historic perspective or anything?
Yeah, well, I think it's very, I tend to gather a lot of information just from observation, you know, just from seeing how different departments and people interact with each other. Like, you know, with an interview where you're sitting face to face, like sometimes anyone can say anything, but, you know, I feel like actually going to a place and feeling the culture, if like seeing how everyone interacts with each other, getting a chance to walk around and be part of the system. I think that I definitely did feel that I missed out a little bit on that through my Zoom interviews, but I tried to augment that by talking with a wide variety of people from the programs that I was interested in. And so I think that you definitely do miss that component of the interview, the context clues, the environment clues, you know, just body language, like those types of things that I think can give you a lot of insight into how a place may fit and how you may fit into a place. But on the other hand, I really did like the fact that I could schedule my interviews more easily. I didn't have to inconvenience my fellow chief residents, like in terms of call schedules and things like that, to travel. It was definitely less expensive, you know, to be able to interview in that way. And so I think that from a convenience standpoint, like being able to talk with so many different people who are like, you know, giants in our field, and have the opportunity to sit down and interview with them through this medium, I don't think that you could achieve that by mandating that everyone has to go and visit different programs. I think that I was talking with a couple other program directors. They've definitely seen an uptick in the number of applications that they've been getting just because of the ease of being able to schedule some of these interviews. And so I don't know, I think that ultimately I'm glad with how everything had turned out. I think you definitely, through your Zoom interviews, miss out on being able to just get a sense of a place that's not necessarily transmitted through talking with someone else. But I think you get an opportunity to see a broader range of programs and talk with more people using this medium in the context of being a busy chief.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it being very stressful because a couple of years before I applied, there weren't that many applicants. And then there was like this huge surge in applicants, and then everybody's applying. And some programs could accommodate people going to 10 interviews, but like, I'm in a 1-year program. Like, you can't go to 10 interviews. Like, it's just not possible. Like, you don't have the coverage. And so there's a disadvantage there. And you lost out on a lot of time for all the interviews that you had to go to. So I think there's some growing pains from going from a fellowship where there were maybe 10 to 15 applicants to, I don't know how many there are now, but there's significantly more and there's a lot more fellowships. And so part of that is, how do you accommodate the applicants? And then I think you're right. Like, it is kind of fun to be able to meet everybody. If there's 40 applicants, it gets more complicated. So, yeah. You know, and it is more egalitarian to have the Zoom realistically.
Yeah, Heather, that's a really interesting question. And Rob, I think maybe you can comment on this. It seemed like the advice that I always got, and maybe it was Heather too, that pediatric neurosurgery application cycle, it kind of tends to go in waves where there are some hot years and then it cools down. But now it seems like the last 3 or 4 years, there's a lot of applicants who need fellowship programs and who also subsequently need jobs. So how, I mean, do you have some of the numbers in your head? And if so, how do you help people find jobs after this? Cause there's clearly not, you know, I think we're training more pediatric neurosurgeons than there's a need for at this point, I would assume so. And I assume that oscillates every couple of years, but what's your thought on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we have 22 applicants this year. I think we average probably between 18 and 20, or something like that, but it definitely has ups and downs. And there's years we have 10 or 12. And I think that there's a lot of anxiety about the job market in pediatric neurosurgery that drives, on some level, applications. I think the insights that chief residents and applicants have about what that job market might be is not great, just because of where they are and they're, you know, I just, nobody knows who's going to retire and where people might be hired. It's just, nobody has like this broad handle on that nationwide. I just don't think that's true. And I've heard a lot of people talk about this at the ASPN. And I think that, you know, with maybe rare exceptions on people that really are looking very specifically at a very narrow geographic area, I think that our fellows have always had multiple opportunities to interview for jobs. And I think that's probably true of a lot of programs. It may be more true in certain years than others, but I guess I'm in a privileged position to say this, but I think that if you like taking care of kids and that's something that drives you in neurosurgery, then I'm not sure that, you know, some sort of, yeah, I think it's hard to see the whole elephant and to judge what you're going to go into in the rest of your life based on what might be there that year that you know of, I think is, I would see it short-sighted. Again, I may be in a very privileged position to say that, but I believe that. In terms of applying for jobs when you're a fellow, what I tell our fellows is this: reach out to a lot of people over the first several months. Reach out to people, hear about opportunities. I'll forward anything I hear to you. I'll respond to emails, I'll forward them to you. We get a lot of those. I would make a lot of loose connections. Again, I think having a vision for your career, being able to articulate that in like the quote unquote elevator pitch or quickly on the fly is an asset, because you're going to run into people at meetings. You're going to be put on the spot in areas you may not have expected that may be fruitful in terms of your job search ultimately. And you're going to be able to sort of pivot and talk a little bit about what you want in your career. And so thinking about that going in, whether you're going to go to, you know, the CNS or how, you know, just be prepared to have unexpected encounters with people that might lead to job opportunities when you're at meetings, and reach out to people, but don't push people too hard before the section. That would be my advice. Like, you know, I think that try to have a broad net and develop a lot of sort of relationships with people, but don't try to hammer anything home because it's not going to probably happen before the section, and then get more serious about it after that and try to see who's serious about you and who you like. And I mean, and that's when I think it sort of picks up in earnest. That's what I tell people. That's certainly what I tell our current fellow and other fellows. Like, cast a wide net, talk to a lot of people, be ready for unexpected encounters at meetings early on, and then sit down around the section and then start to become more serious about the search. That I don't know. I think that serves people fairly well. I'm sure there are a number of approaches to it though. So that's not the only one. But
I guess one of the other questions too that I have, which I think about more now than as a fellow, but if you had to go back and do fellowship now after being out for a couple of years, what would you do differently?
I would do it exactly the same. The last month has been fabulous. No, I think honestly speaking to Rob's point, like, I met James like just in a happenstance cadaver course, and you know, in all honesty, his young face made me be like, oh, a fellow. Fellow. It's like safety. Sorry, you know, I kind of just struck up a conversation with him and we ended up getting along really well, and that's what, you know, led to the interview here at UNM. And yeah, I think that like making sure that you go out there and like talk to a lot of people. I remember like matching, and then later that summer, they're like, oh yeah, what do you think about these applicants? I was like, you're trying to replace me already? This is so soon. I've been here like 2 months. but yeah, like just starting to talk to a lot of different people. I think that I got pretty lucky because my mentors were kind of forwarding things to me and let me know about things going on. And then just having a lot of friendships in other programs, you kind of hear about movement and things like that happening. And so I think, I don't know, right now I'm actually really happy with everything I did. And probably would go to clinic a little bit more.
I think I always wanted to impress. And I think that if I had to go back, I would watch more, you know, like, and that's the wisdom of time, I guess, you know. It's like, you want to prove I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. And then what I realized like years later was like, oh, you know, like, I wish I'd sat back and in many ways, like enjoyed it more, you know, cause you only get 1 year, and you know, that I think that's hard to do in the moment. It's like, if you went back to college when you're 40, you would probably be more diligent maybe about your studying, but you'd have less fun, you know, like, and so it's one of those things, well, when you're training, you're in the middle of fellowship, you're trying to like acquire all this knowledge and to show that you can do it and to prove it. And then when you're out, you know, and you're like, oh, I know how to do it. I wish I could go back and spend a couple months with those guys. And like, and now I know what they were talking about. I didn't really quite understand it all at the time, you know, and I didn't fully understand like some of the challenges at the time. And like, I always think it would be, I really would enjoy going back now and just observing and being like, oh yeah, you know? So I think that's probably what I would do differently.
I guess the equivalent for me on that would be looking back at residency. I actually had this conversation with my husband recently. Like, I wish that I could, and not that I'm like upset with how anything turned out, you know, you need the lumps and bumps along the road. You need to make mistakes to learn and all of those things. And you change one thing and another thing may not have happened. And so I'm very happy with where I am right now. I just wish that like knowing all the things I know now, similar to you, I could like just go back and either not be as like terrified of one of these giants in neurosurgery and actually, you know, ask questions or be willing to be wrong, you know, like when you're starting out. I think that, you know, a lot of us are perfectionists in it and have been like throughout our life. And I think that when I started residency, that was just such a strong factor for me that evolved over time, that I wish I could just tell my younger self, you know, it's okay. Like, it's okay to say, you know, to inquire more, to
be like, more open. I don't really understand.
Yeah.
You know, like, and there are certain things where, you know, I didn't really understand, was afraid to ask, and then you figured it out on your own. But maybe if you'd ask somebody, you could have figured it out in like a tenth of the time. Yeah. And I think that the way our training was, you didn't ask, you were expected just to figure it out. And maybe if you did ask, then you were always afraid, like, what, they're going to think I'm a moron, yeah. You know? And in retrospect, that was my one opportunity to ask people that really knew or were masters in the field or whatever. And, you know, to have the ability to be vulnerable and say, I just don't really understand. I could do it now, and I don't think I could do it as much when I was resident and a fellow.
Yeah, I think from my standpoint, you know, kind of similar sentiments, I would definitely slow down and enjoy it. It was a really wonderful year, but it went by really quickly. It was very busy, and I wish I could have just stopped and smiled more and talked to people more and enjoyed it rather than kind of just thinking about the next thing all the time. Cause I, you know, you're, it's the next day, next day, next day. And then all of a sudden you fall off the cliff and it's July 1st and you're out, you know? I think one thing, you know, and this is very particular to my current practice, is I would have paid attention to the little things, right? So, oh, like I need to get a sedated MRI on this kid in 3 months. You know, at our hospital, it's almost like a community hospital where I do a lot of the pushing and pulling. And so these systems that I really took for granted in residency and fellowship aren't there. And so I had to build those systems, which is fine, but I didn't know how to do that. And so
Ariana and I were having this very conversation this week.
Yeah. So to me,
you don't realize what goes into it. Yes.
Yeah. I would have paid attention to the way the clinic run, because now I run my clinic. You know, I would have paid attention to ordering things from the operating room in terms of supplies and equipment, because now I have to do that. If I need something, I just can't ask for it, you know? And so, and I'm definitely not complaining. I just wish I would have known that before, and I could have spent some more time on that, but it is what it is. And I've definitely, my post-fellowship education has been significant in that sense. I think that's it.
Well, and I think the other thing too, when you go to a fellowship, they're usually the programs that are the most organized and have the most cases and all these things. And so sometimes those systems things are not obvious in a system that works. And so the only way to know that how those systems work is to not have a system and then have to problem solve it. You know, like, it's one of the, I don't even know I would have known what to ask as a fellow, because I just didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, how does the clinic work? It just seems to work so well when I was a fellow. But, you know, if you have a really good clinic administrator, they will do everything. But if you don't, then you do have to figure out how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it gives you an appreciation for the nuts and bolts of everybody that does everything at these large hospitals, especially children's hospitals. My goodness, like, it's just incredible. So I am thankful for that every day. And, you know, I wish I could have learned more about it to make my journey onward easier, but we are here and it is what it is.
Well, I think that we should probably wrap up. Does anybody have any parting comments?
I just have a couple of things that I had thought about saying in preparation, and just one final comment about, I think I'm at, you know, where I am in my career. I've been in practice for 12 years and I think, or 11, but where I am like now, I think one thing I think about a lot, and I totally agree with what you said, Ariana, if you changed one thing, something else may not have happened, and it's very hard to go back and say, and you know what you said, Heather, like, you know, it's very hard to go back as from your perspective now and say how you could have, you can say how you might have optimized that experience, but it's a bit artificial. And I'd say that something that's really important to me now that I think there are elements of to get out of fellowship, whether I would have done it differently or not, I don't know, but I think that some things that are really important about how you are professionally in terms of creating trust with people are, this is from somebody named Allison Kluger, who's a professor at Stanford School of Business, but our expertise, empathy, commitment, and transparency. And she would say that sort of reputation depends upon those things. And those, I think, are all really important values in pediatric neurosurgery. And whether it's taking primary call and developing professional relationships with the nurses and the staff, that you're trustworthy, you're committed, you're empathetic with the patients, and you have expertise and you respond to crisis. I'm not saying you need to have a year of primary call and fellowship, but on some level, being on the front line as somebody committed to the field of pediatric neurosurgery has some value. And I think it's about that. And I think that clinic also is about that. I think clinic's about surgical decision-making and when are you going to, how are you going to do clinical follow-up and surveillance imaging and make challenging surgical decisions. But it's also about communicating very complicated issues to families and showing a commitment to taking care of the most important thing in their life, which is their child, and showing that you're an expert and you're empathetic and you're committed and you're being transparent and that they can trust you. So I think that those are things that are, that I think about a lot these days. And I think that be it the things, I think as a fellow, you're so interested in, you know, becoming an expert and trying to master surgery and complex cases and things like that. I think the other thing is about call that I just wanted to get back to is whatever fellowship you're in and however call is set up, make independent decisions. And don't worry if the faculty gives you feedback and might have done something a little differently, because that's what fellowship is about. But I think you have to put yourself out there and make decisions as if you were an attending and see it as an opportunity to be an attending in pediatric neurosurgery in a protected environment. And you should exercise that opportunity by making decisions and allowing feedback so you can ultimately be better. And I think we do this throughout our career, but fellowship's an important sort of crucible for that. And then what I tell every fellow who comes through and is and I think this gets back to a point Ariana made about going somewhere else. And we encouraged BJ to do that. And I think it's really important is I see neurosurgery residency as a training program. It's an educational experience and mentorship is important, but it's a training program. And the way you do it really well is by showing your attendings, you know, why they do everything a certain way. And you know why they like to, you know, put the retractor here and expose things this way. And they're thoughtful about their decisions and somebody else does it differently, but you can master those things and show them that you've learned those sort of lessons from them and that you're going to graduate a safe neurosurgeon doing those things. And you've absorbed that, you're being trained. And we're all lucky to work with really smart people in pediatric neurosurgery and in neurosurgery in general, people who went into this field and are creative and bright and thoughtful. And to some extent, a training process stifles that. And I think one really fun thing about fellowship is that if you go somewhere else, it sort of reignites a lot of the things that you as a very smart, creative, thoughtful person made you passionate about neurosurgery in the first place, right? Because you see, oh, there's a little bit of a different way of doing things. Like this was the only way I was taught, but that's institutional bias. And you can start to sort of rekindle sort of your own independent thought process as a fellow if you, you know, sort of are exposed to a different program, because they'll have a different way of thinking about it, of approaching problems, and that will sort of reignite that spark in you. And that's really fun to be a part of. And we learn as much from our fellows as they hopefully learn from us. So I think I try to tell that to every fellow, but I think that's really one of the wonderful things that we get to be a part of as in pediatric neurosurgery fellowship. So anyway, I'll stop rambling.
And to add on to that, it's also helpful. I just took my oral boards not too recently, and it's very helpful to know that there is more than one or two or three ways of doing something. And so I think, you know, to have that, it would be really, really good.
I mean, you get an opportunity to make your toolkit a little bit bigger and problem solve in different ways. And that engages your cognitive faculties in a way that sometimes, you know, are a little bit underappreciated in residency.
Keep those faculty phone numbers close by, though. I still use mine all the time.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. Appreciate all your time.